Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and it's time for this week's Friday Morning GM. It's 1/2/26 will be the date this will be out, but we're actually recording this on Wednesday, right around 1 p.m., and it's a little bit difficult for us because we don't have all the information on injuries, but we're going to do a lot of other things. And of course, joining me to do this is Voss Larikos, my co-host. Voss, how you doing?
Doing well, Ken. Happy New Year to you. Happy New Year to Ravens flock. Hope it's filled with prosperity and health for everyone. Been a long, winding season, but by the grace of a rushing offense that got on track in Green Bay and a Cleveland defense that handed the Pittsburgh another loss in Cleveland, Ravens are still in it, still alive, chipping a chair. You know, they can win the next five in a row. They'll hoist a Lombardi. So I'm excited. We'll try to keep the season going as long as we can.
Yeah, it's been exciting, and this will be coming out on the 2nd, but the 1st is the 9th anniversary. That's the answer to the trivia question I posed on the offensive pod. The 1st is the 9th anniversary of the last time the Ravens played a game. That was 1-1 2017, when they did not have a chance to win the Super Bowl. They lost the finale that year to the Bengals 27-10. The previous week, they got beat by the Steelers on Christmas night in the immaculate extension. It is from the Steelers' perspective, it's a failure to have Newszczyk kneel at the 1 yard line that basically led to that loss.
Antonio Brown, yep,
yeah,
it's great. You know, the Ravens haven't had the success in the playoffs that we wanted, but to be every single game of the regular season is meaningful for this period of time. It's great. You know, we look forward to this all summer. We look forward to, you know, spring and summer football season. We want to have as many games that matter as you can. So yeah. I'm here for it. I'm excited.
Yeah, me too. And they got lucky this year that this game matters. It was out of their hands at a point last week, but I'm happy they're here for sure. Both teams for this game looking to bring back every player they can. Most importantly, Lamar Jackson, it's reported he'll practice today. We don't have word on that yet, but it is expected he'll practice Wednesday. I think that bodes extremely well for the likelihood of him playing on Sunday.
Absolutely, and he's a very important player. I know some folks are thinking that Tyler Huntley did a fine job. He probably has the two best wins of the season on his resume, mm-hmm. but obviously Lamar Jackson's a much better player. You're not going to always be able to get the running game going to that extent, so you need to be able to pass sometimes. On the other side of the ball, they're looking for the other side of the field, I should say. TJ Watt, apparently Mike Tomlin is cautiously optimistic that he can return from his lung surgery caused by their own team's training staff. The other important player who kind of carved up the Ravens is DK Metcalf, serving a 2-game suspension. I thought it would be a 1-game suspension based on precedent, but the league said, no, you can't do that. No matter what kind of history you have, 2 games, they hit him with 2. So that's just huge. That's huge for the Ravens.
Yeah, it's enormous. Calvin Austin reportedly back playing. Darnell Washington, though, out for the season with a fractured arm against the Browns. So the Steelers are not in good shape. Pat Freiermuth is the player who worries me a little bit on the Steelers because Rodgers seemed to rediscover him on that final drive as they marched down the field in no time at all. They had too much time, not too much time, but they had a lot of time to score from inside the 15-yard line. And a lot of that was on yards gained by Freiermuth down the middle of the field. What
Carman's
else we want?
Back. Derek Harmon's back.
Derek Harmon. Yeah, so that's a change from the last game where he did not play. And obviously, you mentioned Lamar Jackson, Tyler Huntley, and there's been talk about who plays, and if you have a 70% Huntley and or 70% Lamar and 100% Huntley, does that make a difference? It could, I guess, at some point. Lamar is unhealthy enough, and maybe there's a very thin landing area even where he's unhealthy enough to be the starter, but you'd still want him as the backup ahead of Cooper Rush. It's not too hard to imagine that actually, a place you would want that. But, Jackson is a completely different animal in terms of what the Steelers have to do to defend him. And the Ravens are not going to be faced with the same kind of weakness on the defensive interior that they faced against Green Bay. It's a bad group of players, but then they also had Riley lost very early in that game that extended the problem further. So I don't see any reason why you don't get Lamar Jackson in there, defends every blade of grass. And I thank Tyler Huntley for that Green Bay game in ways that we can't even imagine. But the Ravens were had 34 first downs. Those resulted, the results of those individual series of downs were 25 first downs from there that were not touchdowns, five touchdowns, two field goals, one punt, and one end of game kneel.
Yeah.
So 30 out of 33.
They put it together. You know, the defense put it together against Cincinnati a couple weeks ago. The offense did, they got the running game going. You know, there's no guarantee that they can. Pittsburgh has a tough front. They gave Derrick Henry the ball 25 times in the first matchup. He was under 4 yards of carry. So it's not a guarantee that just feeding him automatically means it works. But I do like the Ravens' chances here. Without Metcalf, their receiving core is really a bunch of washed up, you know, Adam Thielen, MVS type of guys. And, you know, their defense is hit or miss. And Vegas likes the Ravens. The Ravens are 3.5-point road favorites right now. So I'm feeling pretty good about this.
Yeah, it's about a 62% chance if you look at the money line that the Ravens win this game. That's not 100. But we hope by early in the fourth quarter, we're very close to that 100%. And the Ravens can feel comfortable about what they've done. One thing the Ravens are going to have to do, and you mentioned how weak the passing attack is for Pittsburgh, is really consider whether they activate five defensive linemen. They got away in spades with activating just four defensive linemen this last week. To such a degree, it bears mentioning. They only had 43 snaps that were non-kneels on defense. So you start with that, you're going to be in pretty good shape even with four defensive linemen. But they had six snaps from Brent Urban. They had three snaps from Okoye. They only got one snap out of Ajabo, who was an activation that they had that would have potentially been a place where you'd have Josh Tupou on the roster. And, you know, I think this week, they didn't play a single snap of three defensive linemen the entire game. Averagely 1.4 defensive linemen per play. I think things are going to be completely different this week. I mean, I think with the Steelers having the problems with their run game, I think they're going to line up in the base defense a lot this week on early downs, and they're going to force Rodgers to find a way to beat them through the air rather than allow their running backs to take over the game.
Yeah, it's become a pass funnel defense where the majority of teams pass against them. They've had success, and the Ravens have a stout run defense, so a lot of teams just abandon the run willingly. I don't think Pittsburgh is going to do that. Kenny Gainwell, he's really been their playmaker lately. He's the second running back, former Philadelphia Eagle. He's the guy they look to in the red zone. And then Warren's more of their early down, just bruiser. You know, they just don't have the receivers to really attack through the air, I don't think. But the Ravens' corners haven't been doing too great lately either. So hopefully that doesn't become they don't make me eat my words.
Yeah. Well, I'll go along with that too. Don't expect Peebles to be active this week again. If they do want Tupou to be the fourth nose tackle for the game, which I think makes a lot of sense, it's worked very well in previous weeks in terms of stopping the run. I think it makes sense to add Josh Tupou, but they have to add him to the 53. They can't elevate him. So that means they have to cut someone, and the cuts are getting tougher and tougher here. As we get to the end of the year, Carl Jones is still on the roster, though, and I guess David Ajabo would be the other major choice.
Ajabo, agreed, and I would also say Cooper Rush, who's been hanging around for all, you know, the second half of the season. They don't necessarily need a third quarterback. The roster's three deep only at running back and tight end are the two places of three deep. Inside backer, they are now with the activation of Jay Higgins, who's slotted in ahead of Jones. And, you know, those are the only places. So where else can you cut from? I think they're also going to need to make a move potentially with the reactivation of Ben Cleveland. I'd like to get your thoughts on that. But first on Tupou, I believe I saw a report that he was actually injured and that's why he couldn't play last week. But I can't find it. So I don't know if I'm imagining things or if that's a possibility. I'm hoping that Jeff Zarebeck or someone will put out the report here while we're recording and that'll give us some clarity.
It's conceivable, but 2 weeks ago, Tupou was active ahead of Okoye.
Right.
So it would surprise me slightly, and it would mean that it really had to happen in the game versus New England that made it impossible for him to play against Green Bay. It's certainly a violent sport. It might have happened. I think that it's more credible that it was the third elevation they'd already used for Tupou against New England, and so they weren't going to use it for Green Bay, and they kind of decided we want him for these one of two games, and we'll kick the can down the road, and then we'll activate him to the 53 if necessary thereafter. They don't have really easy cuts on the roster. They probably don't consider Carl Jones an easy cut because of the special teams contribution he could make, but Carl Jones could be cut, re-signed, and elevated from the practice squad. So,
So we'll see how it shakes out. They do need a couple more big bodies on for special teams, the bigs, as you've talked about. The return of Tavius Robinson has alleviated some of that. I think that's also allowed them to go a little bit lighter on the D-line because Tavius and Draymond Jones can kick inside. But you don't want to be in a place where John Jenkins gets dinged up and you don't have enough bodies to finish the game on the D-line and they just run it down your throat and end your season. So in theory, I would like more skill set variety on the D-line with the Peebles who can get after the passer probably better than some of the other guys. Maybe there's a matchup where that makes more sense in the postseason. So we'll see.
Yeah, I Peebles would not be my guy right now. I think against the Steelers, it's clearly the four nose tackle and Brent Urban group is what I'd like to see. I think they can play some uncovered if they want to. We did see, you mentioned it, but they saw the first two snaps of Race Car this last week. So they're in for the last series for Green Bay before Willis got hurt. They used that for two downs. And honestly, it was just a function of needing to get Travis Jones off the field. He put a lot of consecutive snaps, but it is something that's in their pack. They can use it when they need to.
Well, they do. They need to, I would say, more often, potentially. Their pass rush has not been good enough this year. Maybe that's a way to get to dial it up where you need it to be. Other elevations, the only other guy that could possibly be elevated is Amari Oruwariye, who did get an elevation earlier for special teams. That would be if maybe there's a little uncertainty at cornerback. Apparently, Marlon may play with a cast. There's a little bit of a cloudiness to his injury with the hand that he's been dealing with.
Oh, yeah. That's obviously Marlon's had a whole series of injuries this year. The other guy that they could elevate again would be William Kwenku as another special teams big. If they felt like they needed him, they cut Jones and he didn't make it through waivers. The most likely thing is the Steelers claim him and they want to know what the Ravens are doing on special teams. So it could be something like that. It's not something I normally associate with the Steelers doing. It's more of a New England thing, but
Patriots.
Let's see. You mentioned Ben Cleveland, Justice Hill possibly returning this week. We might hear before we're off the air here today.
Yes, I believe John Harbaugh made a comment on his Monday press conference that Justice Hill could possibly return this week. There's no guarantee that he'd be able to return quickly. He has suffered a neck injury. So Jeff Zeribek has indicated or intimated that Hill may not be ready to return to the field anytime soon. I don't know if they necessarily need him. That would just put another pinch on activations again, and now you're taking away an outside linebacker or an offensive lineman or somebody you don't want to. But right now, as the roster currently sits, 26 on offense, 3 on special teams, 25 on defense. So if Ben Cleveland is reactivated, they need to make that move. But I do think your idea of releasing Jones and bringing up Kwenku solves your special teams need there. So, and they can get through a game without having as many special teams bigs. They did the game where somebody got hurt on the first drive? Buchanan got hurt, and they had to tough it out. And we saw Ricard on special teams as a lead blocker on a kickoff, I believe, too, which is – so they can make it through. You got to pick where you're going to go there. So we'll see.
Yeah, that was an interesting formation that you mentioned on the kickoff, because Ricard was kind of like an up back. You have to have two guys between the goal line and the 20, and he was kind of an up man of those two, which means only one guy is back there to return the ball, and Ricard is ahead to block. It's an interesting wrinkle. I'm glad they tried that.
I thought of that early on when I said, do they really need Ali to be a second kick returner? Can't Ricard do that? Yeah. And turns out,
We got a fairly high profile release this week. Trayvon Diggs released by the Cowboys after a very bad season, by the way. He played 8 games, started 6, didn't play particularly well. I'll get into that in a minute. But the as reported by Jordan Schultz, I'm giving you the framework right here. They played a Thursday game on Christmas in Washington. Diggs mm-hmm. is from the somewhere in the DMV and has family there that lives there during the off season. Wanted to stay with them for a couple extra days. Asked the Cowboys if he could do it. Was Brian Schottenheimer told no. He asked again. They told him no louder. And then they and he said he was just gonna come back on the first flight after they got back to Dallas. It didn't make any sense. And you know, part of the thing, teams control their players in ways to keep them out of trouble. So right. For one thing, I don't know if everybody knows this. If you play a home game, doesn't mean you like drive in from your house to go to the ball game on the morning of a 1 p.m. game. You know, you stay at a hotel downtown with the rest of the right. team. And basically the reason they do it is to keep the players on lockdown so they won't do something stupid.
Yeah, and even that report they had, that random report on Reddit or whatever, said that the Ravens have bodyguards at the hotel to prevent the players from sneaking out.
Yeah. It's not surprising at all, by the way. But anyway, they in the case of Diggs, he mentioned he had a bad season. That doesn't even begin to cover it. 14.3 yards per target, 158.3, a perfect opposition passer rating, giving up zero interceptions and three touchdowns allowed. You compare that to Marlon Humphrey, by the way, who's having a bad year. And a lot of it's due to injuries, but I think there are legitimate concessions to age in his case as well. He's got four interceptions, three touchdowns allowed, an 89 passer rating against, and 9.6 yards per target, which is terrible, but not as bad as Diggs is, not even in the same area code as how bad Diggs is. And, you know, I'm certainly talking about Marlon moving to safety next year. In the case of Diggs, I don't know how you bring a guy like this back. And most people who are saying, yeah, let's go take a chance on him, are looking at his 2021 interception total, right. 11, and yeah, are excited about that.
He was one of the best ball hawking corners there for a while, got paid, and injuries just, I think, lower leg injuries took away his athleticism. And I don't know if he's ever going to get it back. It would only cost about $500,000 if the Ravens wanted to put him on the roster for this week, but I don't see the purpose. I just don't think he has it anymore. His brother apparently might be suspended now too.
I saw.
Which would be, he got an apparently a charge filed, and that would be monumental for the postseason in the AFC.
Yeah, that obviously it would be. He's their the star receiver for the Bills, and star receiver for the Patriots, and he's one of their very significant weapons. He destroyed the Ravens in the game.
Yep, him and Metcalf both. So you play against the teams without the number one receiver. It's helpful.
Let's see. We don't know players not practicing yet today.
No, I still don't see it up here.
Okay.
So, here we go.
Okay.
Jeff Zerebeck. Lamar, 1 second ago, Lamar Jackson back is practicing for the Ravens. So
great.
That's what we have so far. Maybe he'll have a follow-up with any other players. We'll keep an eye on that.
We probably will. Let's go through the mailbag first, then we'll come back to that. We got a lot of questions today, so we can't always get to all the questions. I'll say this, and some hypotheticals and whatnot are probably kind of questions we'll drop, although we're going to do one, I think, in this episode. We'll start with Angelo of 85, a very frequent contributor. Appreciate all your questions. Excellent solo pod, Ken. Maybe you'll discuss this more on matchups for Friday Morning GM. Is there an episode or another episode this week? But would you deploy four nose tackle front and sell out to stop the run, particularly with no Metcalf? Ravens had no sacks the last time he played, but did stop the run effectively. Answer very simply is yes, that's exactly what I do. I'd stop the run first. And I think the Ravens, with their four nose tackle group, have made Travis Jones much more impactful as a three tech. So I've been very excited about that.
Yeah, I was going to make the same point. If you can keep Travis Jones fresh and allow him to be more of a pass rusher, that's helpful. If you have more nose tackles, it also maybe helps you deploy less bodies so you can keep your safety back. I don't ordinarily think going into a game saying we must stop the run is a great idea. I think there's been times where it makes sense to invite the run. But in this situation, without Metcalf, I do think it's a good idea.
Ravens, by the way, did not even have we already talked about that earlier. Let's not do it again. Brandon Croxton. This is an interesting one. Hypothetical. If the Ravens only have one big contract to give this year, and you have two choices, Tyler Linderbaum at $18 million per year or Trey Hendrickson as a UFA at $25 million per year. Now, by the way, Voss, we've talked about this all during the season. I think you're lower on your willingness to pay Tyler Linderbaum as of right now. I'm The data points are continually coming in. This last game from Linderbaum was outstanding. He had 18 level two blocks, which is the most I've ever seen. I'm now at a point where if they pay him $18 million, I'm okay with it. It should match the Creed Humphrey contract. It's an overpay relative to that, but there has been a year that's passed. So we're talking about that's the number that makes sense. I wouldn't go higher. I wouldn't reset the market at 19 or 20 million, but I'd be okay with 18. What's your number on Linderbaum, first of all, currently?
I mean, I think there's almost two numbers. If the Ravens are going to stay cap conservative, my number would be closer to maybe 12. If they are going to say, we've painted ourselves into a corner here, we've paid some devalued positions, and now we have to find a way to improve the pass rush, the O-line, and now potentially cornerback, which I think we'll get to in a minute here, and we're going to be more aggressive with void years, not go all the way Philadelphia has, but go another 20% in that direction, then I'd be okay bringing Linderbaum back at a higher cost. So it's kind of a two-pronged thing. To me, though, I just still don't want to pay. I don't want to have a cornerstone contract as a guy that's an average pass blocker, as well as he does in the run game. So that's the big question. Can he? What if he pass blocks great in this game against Hayward and their other big guys, Benton, I guess, and then you go into then you play Texas, Houston, and they have some good and they pass rush or pass blocks well there. Then he has earned more money, in my view.
Okay. I'm don't need to make it contingent anymore. I think I know who Tyler Linderbaum is at this point, in terms of the things, and he's certainly delivered as a run blocker. The other thing that I like about what has happened in the last week, and the other reason why I'm up to 18 now, is I think he actually really it's been made clear that he's a very good complement to Fa'alele and the Fa'alele successor, I hope, in terms of being a duo blocker who can do some good things there. So, this last game was 18 blocks in level two. A lot of those were climbing off duo blocks at the line of scrimmage, combination blocks. And Fa'alele was helped in that regard. It's been a criticism of mine of Linderbaum that he hasn't, that's been a weakness in his run game blocking. And pretty much the only one is that he doesn't completely get his duo block off these pins so that the guard can finish him before he climbs. Right. And that's put him in some difficulty. But anyway, I'm at that point. And there is value in giving Tyler Linderbaum a $12 or $13 million offer, even if you know he won't accept it. It allows him to go out to the market in a stronger position to negotiate a contract. Departing players appreciate that. And then he'll go and he'll find a significantly higher contract. But the first thing he can do if he walks into Dallas or some other, team that decides they just have to have him is to say, look, the Ravens are offering me, $12 or $13 million. That's the starting point for any negotiation. So, I'm looking for 18. And I think that makes more sense, blah, 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 blah.
What I don't want them to do is to feel the pigeonhole that they have to bring him back because the guard situation is uncertain.
Right.
I think that might have led to the Mark Andrews contract. They said, we don't have any tight ends under contract. And now we're seeing what we think. Maybe they overpaid there. So you can't make the decision that way, I don't think. I don't like that style of decision-making. I think it leads to problems.
Yeah, completely agree. And there are lots of good centers that end up being available in the second and third round. There are also duds that you can get in those rounds. But believe me, the number of duds you get in the first round tend to be much higher. Billy Price and Garrett Bradbury, even those guys lasted in the league for a few years, they weren't very good. Garrett Bradbury's still playing in the NFL.
The smaller zone blocking guys too. Maybe not always, but for the most part, those are the ones that don't. And then the Packers took Jenkins. Was he in the second round? He might have been the top of the second. And then he was a center, and now he moved out to tackle. But the other one's McCoy.
The Packers, I think you're thinking of
Elton Jenkins.
Elton Jenkins. Okay. Well, so he's Zach played Tom, all over their left tackle was drafted as an interior guy, and he was the guy that I wanted instead of Linderbaum. In that year, he would have been a cheap later round pick, who's ended up being a good left tackle, which is really weird.
But you want to get back to your impose your will on the other team style of football. I think you want a big body center, a Ryan Jensen type center, or Jason Brown was the other big one they had that was moving people.
Yeah, I could be Quentin Newyear and some of the other guys they had in the very early days of Ravens. Wally Williams, I guess, would have been in that group.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, he was good. Anyway, back to the question from Brandon. So Linderbaum at 18 or Trey Hendrickson, who's a UFA at $25 million a year.
I'm not all that excited about Hendrickson at $25 million a year after sitting out a full season. And he's now, what is he, 31? I've got to look at this here real quick to see where he is. Yeah, he's 31 years, 26 days. He turned 31 earlier in December. So he'll be 32 during the season next year. The typical 32-year-old pass rusher is truly going to be 80% of the player at 20% of the price, as Hendrickson is. I would rather go to that bucket rather than sign a guy like Hendrickson for multiple years.
Yeah. So I'm not too excited about Hendrickson either for the reasons you've mentioned. Max Crosby's apparently on the block, or they deactivated him to keep his trade value high, and he was pissed off about that. Now, he's 28, but if you're going to – the most I would do is you give the first and get the second back, something like that. Uh-huh. You can't give up – you can't mortgage the picks and the cap at the same time.
Exactly.
The UFA I do like, supposed to be a UFA, is Jalen Phillips, who we talked about around the trade deadline, went to the Eagles, has not put up gaudy sack numbers. However, he's seventh in the league in pressures this season. And he's in his prime. He's a young guy, first-round talent. So if that was the question, I think I'd rather pay the pass rusher, even though it costs you 30% more, because I do think winning with four is going to be a key going forward for the defense.
Okay, let's say you're at a neutral point at $18 million on Linderbaum, which I know you're not. Okay, mm-hmm. But if that was your fulcrum point, your seesaw point where it was you're ambivalent. Mm-hmm. What's your number on a Jalen Phillips in terms of an AAV on a, let's say, a 3-year deal?
About 25. I think OTC has him valued at 24. It's opportunity cost. Is it going to cost you, or are they going to loosen the purse string so the opportunity cost is lessened? And that would apply to either player.
Right. That's true. And that obviously neither of us was in favor of going after Micah Parsons earlier this year. And again, it's the same problem. It's a cap and trade. And I saw something just silly out there, obviously, that the Ravens would trade Bateman and their next two first-round picks in exchange for Crosby. That's ridiculous, folks. That's absolutely absurd.
And I think he's got $30 million cap hits coming up, even though they keep Now, if you could find somebody whose contract was heavily signing bonus, so that your cap hits that you're inheriting are lower than market value, then giving up the pick, I think, makes more sense.
Yeah, then you look at it. Of course, Bateman's had a bad year, so it doesn't make his contract look like it has the most inherent value in it anymore, certainly. That said, I think it would be a mistake for the Ravens if they could trade that contract somehow to do so without getting value. I really would not be happy with that if the Ravens ended up with it. I think if Lamar is healthy again, we'd see the extended play value of Bateman, shine through again. It's just there were unrealistic expectations of him this year of, 1,100, 1,200 yards kind of thing and a 20% increase in targets. It doesn't work that way here in Baltimore.
Right. All right, let's hit the next question from Dan Anderson. With Marlon's decline as a cornerback and possible move to safety, how do the Ravens rebuild the CB room? Longer Beam and Kone are unknown. Tampa's unproven. Martin is a slot only, and Awuzie will likely command a significant contract in free agency, leaving us with Wiggins as the only proven corner.
Well, he's right about exactly the diagnosis of all those things, and I still don't think they can return Marlon to corner. I think that there's too much risk that what's happened to Marlon this year is truly concession to age as opposed. Every day, companies you've never heard of are making millions off your personal data. Your name, address, phone number, even details about your family are pulled from public records on the internet, then sold without your consent. There's an entire marketplace built on your privacy, and most people have no idea it exists. Aura fights back. Aura removes your personal data from broker sites and keeps it off. Aura also alerts you fast if your information shows up in a breach or on the dark web. But Aura is more than just a data broker removal system. It's a full digital security suite that protects every part of your online life. Aura gives you a VPN to stay private, antivirus to block threats, a password manager for safer logins, and spam call protection to shut down scammers. Aura scans the dark web for your most sensitive information and notifies you instantly if anything is exposed. And if your identity is ever stolen, you're backed by up to $5 billion in insurance and 24/7 U.S.-based fraud support. Other service charges about the same, but only cover one or two areas. Aura gives you everything. Data broker removal, identity and credit monitoring, device protection, and fraud support all in one simple app. Aura removes what's already exposed, protects what's not, and puts you back in control. Go to aura.com/remove for complete digital protection and peace of mind. That's aura.com/remove.
This is the new Weight Watchers. It works for members like JoJo, who's learning simple, healthy habits, Sharia, who's making progress with meds, and Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of. Watch it work. Get started today at WeightWatchers.com.
To just the injuries he's had. And he's had some injuries, there's no doubt about it. But you know, I'm in favor of making use of Marlon's portable skills and moving him to safety. And I'd be willing to do it this postseason. I think there's potential for a shock and awe value to it that could help the Ravens, you know, improve in the postseason the way that the triple switcheroo on the offensive line did in 2012. But he's right. I mean, Longerbeam and Kone are going to be competing for spots, and we don't know who they are. It's a terrible place to be with a second-year player, but that's where we are. Tampa's a third-year player. We have no idea who he is as a corner. So yeah,
going into his third year.
It's tough.
It's tough, you know, because now you're adding another need to the draft board or the pre-agent shopping list. So I would be in favor of bringing back Awuzie. If you move Marlon to safety, you're now saving the, you know, $5 million or $6 million, whatever it is, for Gilman / Ardarius, potentially. So you take that money and put it with what Awuzie made this year, give him a pay raise, bring him back. If not, you're probably in the same situation where you're going out looking for the next Ronald Darby, Awuzie. I mean, there's been a string of them here, but I do think you're going to need to add somebody in free agency to help cornerback when Marlon makes that move.
All right, I think they keep Washington would be my guess. I think for $3 million, $3.5 million, it's going to be a prove it deal anyway. I think they keep him. He represents multiple position coverage, very much like an old Jimmy Smith contract where they thought, we love him. He can cover us at corner, but he's not going to be our starter, or he can step in at safety if we need him to do that. And I think that's where
Brandon Carr, same deal.
So be very happy with that.
And if you get a better pass rush, maybe that helps the cornerbacks out too next year.
Yeah. Okay, let's go. SS in Baltimore in B-more has just a comment. The cornerback position is so hard with such a tiny margin for error that when a great vet is released, it may be an indication that they've lost a quarter step, which at that position can move a player from all pro to liability. Maybe that's what happened with Jair. I think he's also saying that reflexively with the Trayvon Diggs release. But appreciate the comment. Don't disagree at all. And in terms of what Jair happened, obviously Jair was not the same player that the Ravens thought he was, which made him the unfortunate signing of the year. And I tell you what, it wasn't apparent in camp that he would be so awful when the season began. He hurt a lot.
His knee flared up in camp and he had his knee drained, and it seemed that after that point. But if you think about it, the cornerback position requires more raw athleticism than any other position on the field, I would say, as far as change of direction, recovery speed, everything. So those players are the most susceptible to decline when they're not healthy and when the injuries start adding miles on their body.
Yeah, completely agree. Completely agree. We'll go to the next one. This is a Reddit question from somebody throw a pie. Is there a potential cap recovery from insurance on Matabike? Okay, so I did talk to Brian McFarlane about this, or I just messaged him, and he said that he didn't think there was any significant recovery involved. Certainly nothing like the amount, but that the Ravens did have some insurance on the signing bonus for Matabike that they might recover on. So but he thinks the order of magnitude is single-digit millions, like $2 or $3 million, and not, you know, $30 million or whatever in dead money the Ravens are going to end up with on his contract. So assuming that you know, Matabike really is done for his career, this is a very significant milestone cap event for the Ravens that hurts like hell. And you know, the Chris Davis contract for the Ravens for the Orioles was a lot worse. But this one is, you know, they're going to end up eating about 12%, 11 or 12% of 1 year's cap over the course of several years. They have some ways they can move that money around and eat it over multiple years, but it's obviously it's a very bad situation.
Absolutely correct. We'll see how that one plays out. Great information from you there and from Brian. Thank you for that, because I don't know the nuance of that. I wish, as just of a macro level, the Ravens would have more flatter contract structure as far as eating some of the money in the first couple years. And then it leads to some players being extended that you don't necessarily want to extend. The one I always point to is Joe Flacco in 2016, I believe, off of an ACL and negative interception touchdown ratio. And now they're in that position with Lamar coming into this offseason too.
Well, they are. And you got risks on both sides. But just earlier in this very same podcast, Voss, you talked about how you'd be okay if the Ravens, at least that's the way I took it, went 20% of the way towards the Philadelphia Eagles in terms of, setting up more long-term void year, that kind of debt. That's the same basic argument there, is you don't want to have backloaded contracts.
I think it's a little different because it's not tied to the player necessarily. You're borrowing the money, but it's not tied to the player, which then makes it easier to get out of contracts. We saw them restructure Roquan before this season and not necessarily using void years, to my knowledge, that if he wasn't restructured, that cap number would be awfully appealing to try to trade him this offseason. But now there's lesser savings. We've seen it with a lot of different guys. So I see what you're saying there as far as you're borrowing from the future, but it doesn't incentivize you to extend a player you wouldn't otherwise, I don't think, with void years, because there's no real – the void years aren't attached to them, right?
I see it as just another form of future borrowing. If you're saying it doesn't put you in the same position to make a difficult decision later, that you're worried about these dollars were A dollars or they're B dollars, they're dollars of cap. And you know, you're spending them in advance when you use void years. The argument I think that might be better for void years is that you have some sort of a chance to change those void years or negate them by restructuring a contract. And if that were true, then I'd buy into the argument in some sense. But we just went through that with Ronnie Stanley, and those void years had to be eaten anyway, at least the way that contract was structured, when they re-signed him to a different deal.
So let's look at Odell Beckham, for example, because that one had a lot of void years. It wasn't a two-year deal with the first-year cap hit at $5 million and the second-year cap hit at $25 million. It was a low cap hit with void years. So you know you had to pay it, but it didn't say, well, now let's bring him back. Let's make it a three-year deal. Let's extend Roquan or let's extend Marlin so we don't have to have these big cap numbers. I'd rather have it just not attached to the player so you can make clear decisions.
Okay, so in the case of – it went just the opposite direction in the case of Odell. They basically had their original contract, which had him paid over, I think, 2 years or maybe 3 years, whatever it was. But the void years were there. I think it was 2 years because it was a one-year deal and they were going to have to eat all the void years. Then they re-signed him to that contract that was null and void from the moment it was signed and set up for a post-June 1 release so that they could float that money over further years from that point. And in fact, he's Odell Beckham, the 2023 Ravens superstar, is still a 2025 Ravens dead money number because of
right, him. Right, right. But they just borrowed the money to put it towards anything, not to
But I agree with that. I'm just saying you borrow the money in any case to do. We could talk about this another time. I think.
Let me just ask the question though. Do you think the structure of these massive quarterback contracts is the best option for the team, or would you prefer flatter?
I mean, if you go flatter, then you're you don't end up with as good a spending profile in terms of being able to spend more cash in that year. I think the Ravens have done a good job of kind of riding the fence in a middle ground of cash expenditure. So DaCosta says they try and put themselves in the top half of cash expenditures. And by the way, when they do the State of the Ravens event, one of the things that they really have pointed out to the suite holders is we need to be in the top half of revenue in the league. Not that we need to be number one. We're never going to be number one, but we need to be in the top half of revenue. And so they're always trying to figure out how can we improve that. It's a very reasonable position to take. I think the biggest thing organization, well, you know, I think we have a question coming up about that. So maybe I'll try and get it there rather than and try and answer it here.
Let me make one more point just popped in my head. Apparently the NFL is they're potentially going to renegotiate the TV deals, which could be another massive boon for its salary cap. And maybe that gets you out of the Matabike mess on its own.
It'd be a get you out of a portion of it. You still have that obligation relative to other teams. So if it goes, it's better if it goes down to 9% of cap, but still it's 9% of cap you don't have, and other teams have even more cap. They have an overflow of cap from the additional TV money.
Agreed. No question. It's a tough one. Tough one for Matt BK. What any percentage chance that he could come back, you think? Would you put it at 5%?
I am not privy to anything about, you know, I would think it's higher than 5%, but I'm not privy to anything. You know, we heard that one Reddit user who came in claimed to be an ex-girlfriend and then apparently provided the R Ravens some information on that. I think the Ravens PR department might have come in and actually, you know, tried to get them to take that down, and they did. They took down the post on it, but she claimed that Matabike had already moved back to Texas and had already retired.
He put a tweet up, I think, this week. Yuri showed me, and then he has since taken it down. But he said something like, "The journey is a blessing" or something. So they're always kind of hard to read. That so those kind of things. Does that mean recovery, or does that mean you're enjoying all the money you made and you're going to, you know, I don't know. But
the next stage in life is exciting. Blah blah blah. It could mean a lot of things. Anyway, I wish the best for Matabike. And we talk about him on this show in a lot of really hard terms, but it's a personal tragedy for him, obviously, to lose the rest of his career to this, if that's the way it ends up. And you know, I really do feel bad for the guy. All right, we got a hypothetical question. We'll go from Gua Shalou, who's a German fan. And he says, would you rather... Okay, you got two choices here. And would you rather win the Super Bowl this year and John stays for the next 10 years and we don't go back to the Super Bowl during that time? Or we don't win the Super Bowl this year, we get a new coach, we reach the Super Bowl at least three times in 10 years, but if we win, if we get there, you don't know if we win the game. He said this is just a thought experiment, not to take anything out of it. But the problem is that there's a bunch of people out there who are the Harbaugh hate crew are basically going to say, yeah, that's exactly the way it might played out. They could make it to the Super Bowl this year. Whether they win or lose, it doesn't really matter. And then we're stuck with Harbaugh for 10 more years. Harbaugh's going to be 73 years old in 10 years. I don't believe he's a year older than I am. I don't believe he's going to be around regardless in 10 years. So from that standpoint, hypothetically, but of those two choices, I always go for the better, total. If they went to the Super Bowl three times, I'd expect them to win at 1.5. But I tell you what, I'd have a hell of a lot of fun going to three Super Bowls.
Absolutely. Plus, you're also projecting out they're going to be pretty damn competitive the next decade, which doesn't have anything in the first scenario. So I would take that for sure. That's the dream, right? The bite at the apple. More bites at the apple. They've never been to more than one Super Bowl in a decade. So you give them three chances, that'd be great.
But the problem is the lack of causality also there. Just it didn't come together well. But I appreciate the question, Gua. Thanks for contributing to the mailbag. Another one from Angelo85. Hi, Ken and Voss. When a coach or coordinator is terminated, is there a way certain members of the coaching staff can remain, or is everyone removed? Which position coaches should the Ravens try to retain, even if they clean house? That's a reasonable question. And for the head coach, I think there would be a lot of change, much more change, and broad change would be a function of it. So if they do decide to move on from Harbaugh, it's going to mean a lot of changes up and down the coaching staff. But it doesn't mean that some of those people won't effectively re-interview for their job and get them.
We saw with Rex Ryan, right? Rex Ryan was retained off of Brian Billick's staff, and he was a defensive coordinator for John Harbaugh. So if you have one side of the ball that's doing great, we've seen that happen several times. As far as specific position coaches, you know, I think Dr. Rush seems like a pretty good asset. Tight ends coach, I'm not quite sure who that is, but, you know, you might want to keep some of that. Goddard, yeah. He's certainly developed Charlie Kolar pretty well. I think you're looking at a new offensive line coach either way, and probably some new coaches on the defensive side of the ball either way. So But yeah, you can keep whoever you want or replace everybody. If you go a whole different direction, you could be installing a whole new scheme, and you might want to have totally different. You know, if you go to a West Coast offense or something, you're going to want to have different kind of people.
And I just made a mistake. It's George Godsey. I knew I'd said it wrong. Godsey. Because Goddard is the tight end for Dallas, or yes. Used to be at one point. Sorry about that, George. Because I know you're listening. I know you're listening to this show. but there are a lot of coaches who would immediately be gone for certain if Harbaugh was gone. An example would be Pagano. I don't think he would get retained under any circumstances. I don't think Warhop is retained. I think a new coaching staff comes in and looks for a new great offensive line coach. It provides you that opportunity. So in some ways, you know, if you're looking for a good reason why you might want to get rid of Harbaugh, it's to get rid of a bunch of weak assistant coaches that he won't get rid of if you really felt that way. The Harbaugh tree has been generally very successful in producing outstanding coaches that moved on to bigger and better things in other places. It's one of the strengths. So the whole notion that you're going to get rid of bad coaches because you fire Harbaugh is probably kind of a fool's way to think of it.
Yeah. The flip side of that coin is if they determine they do need to make a change, especially on the defensive side, do you want Harbaugh making that next hire as he continues to get older? Anyway,
Hold on. Let's talk about that for a second. Harbaugh has made what defensive coaching hires, and which one of those didn't work out? I mean,
I would say this one didn't work out. I mean, they have so many blown leads. It's been really tough with the blown leads this year. I think Zach Orr, he brought in Pease. He had to bring in Pease last year to help him
McDonald,
out. Brilliant. McDonald's great. Yeah. So what he did there was great because he gave him that year at internship, and then he kind of did the complete opposite with Orr. He was complete neophyte play caller, never called plays anywhere. So anyway, let's move on to the next one if you're ready. So Timothy Hancock, why do you think the defense is regressing to how they were performing the first five games? I'm assuming he means during the five-game win streak. Is it scheme, players, or a combination of both?
I mean, you're not leaving all the possibilities in terms of the regression. I mean, they played very well coming off of an incredibly injured start to the season. They've had additional injuries, particularly in the secondary, which have hurt them. Marlon Humphrey being a big one. The other guy who's taken a step back is Wiggins, in terms of his play. That's very disappointing. But it just doesn't seem to trust his recovery speed in the same way. And he may be asking to do too much, and the Ravens may be asking him to do too much in terms of any kind of chase responsibilities for receivers. I think it'd be better if he, you know, learned to play better over one shoulder as opposed to move around and try and cover the best receiver that the other team has.
Yeah, I think it's a combination. Certainly, I'd like to see tighter coverages called or executed by the players. I think the zones have been too soft. It's been similar to some of the Dean Pease critiques we had. And when you have four first-round picks in your secondary, you expect to be able to play a little bit more aggressive coverage. I also think the other thing that's overlooked is competition. Drake May, obviously, he's one of the best deep ball throwers in the league. And I think that's overlooked a lot of times when we see these trends. Oh, look, the last six games after they traded Roquan, the defense improved. The last five games since they moved Kyle Hamilton, the defense improved. That's all true, but there's a lot of factors that go into it. Yeah. That's one of the real interesting things about football. It's just so hard to pinpoint any one thing at any one time. You got 11 different guys going at different things. But a level of competition, I would point to, that was one of the reasons why Zach Orr was praised for turning it around last year, was because level of competition was not as tough in the beginning of the year. So I think just got to play better, more pass rush and tighter coverages. Hopefully they can work that out through the next game and beyond.
Yeah. I completely agree, by the way, with the comments you make about quality of competition being a very big deal in this. If you look at what's happened with the pass rush, I think the thing I'm happy about with Orr or whoever else is working with Orr on the defense is the defense has had to make a number of very significant adjustments this year to lack of personnel. And the first one was losing Matabike and having to deal with the four nose tackle issue and had a best aligned, very limited assets on the defensive line. And not only did they do it, they got great play out of Travis Jones in the process, even at a higher level than he'd ever played before. If you're looking for what happened in the secondary, I think the secondary became more aggressive and attacking in terms of getting the football away, at least in terms of some of the games played since they were at their nadir in week five or so. So you can at least point to that. And I think that if you want to talk about getting Roquan back and what a change that's made, I think they've made adjustments to improve the value of Roquan within the kind of some of the limitations of personnel that they have. That said, they spent a lot of money on the defense. I mean, it's kind of like the Steelers of last year. There aren't a lot of excuses for not playing good defense, and particularly for the secondary to lay the egg they have this year. Is a function of a lot of things. Of Malachi Starks probably not being quite the player they hoped he would be right away. It's a function of Wiggins, trending down after, he was the real star performer at the beginning of the year. It's a function of Humphrey being hurt the whole year, not really finding the playing time for Awuzie. And
he missed a game. Yeah, he missed
Gilman not being a good tackler, a lot of things.
Or great in coverage. You don't have great range. I think that's another one. Just point to that. There's been season. Look how much the defense has improved because of Aloy Gilman. And it's not that line, causation, correlation, that sort of thing. So, we're going to skip this one about the Lamar situation article because that just doesn't really give us a whole lot of.
By the way, I do have a short video that just came out yesterday, actually, on exactly that topic and what my thoughts are on that. I'm not at all happy that kind of an article gets written. And I think it's really.
Agreed completely.
All right. We don't need to talk about it.
Rod Woodson went to bat for Lamar yesterday, which was great to see, and say, these guys are humans. Even if everything he says is true, or even if it's happening now, which that's all very debatable, he was an All-Pro Hall of Famer, and he did a lot of stuff like that too. It's not a big deal. So
good for him.
He said he used to eat, some kind of bonbons or something all day, every day. Rod Woodson.
Wow. Okay.
which was funny. Where is that? Do you have that one in front of you?
I have it. Yeah. So Prof Boggs basically asked, if you were Steve Bisciotti, what three changes would you make this off season? So Voss and I were talking about this a little bit during our production meeting. And one of the things that is foremost in my mind is that Bisciotti is not a guy who reaches down into the organization to make decisions. He's a true CEO. So he sits at the top of this organization that has four major silos with Sashi Brown and Chad Steele and Harbaugh and DaCosta all reporting to him separately. But he's not going to reach down to somebody who's two levels below John Harbaugh and make a move. Mm-hmm. If he thinks it's not being handled properly, he thinks he wasn't handling his department properly, he might fire Harbaugh. But he ain't no way he's reaching down into the organization to make changes.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree with that point. But just in the spirit of this question, let's pretend he's a little bit more meddling than he really is. Three things. I think you want an offensive play caller as head coach. You got one of the young hotshot guys like Kubiak or LaFleur. I think you want to pair him with a veteran defensive coordinator that's been around the league for a while, that's an attacking kind of guy, like a Jim Schwartz or a Flores. And DaCosta, from that perspective, I would say you got to adjust the levers of your valuation to reflect positional value 25% to 30% more.
Okay, so for that, those kind of elements, he can talk to a new head coach that he interviews about those first two things. In terms of DaCosta, he can tell him whatever he wants because he's a direct report in terms of what he wants. I'm going to go with some other outside the box things. So first thing I want to do is the Ravens are in a very unfortunate position in terms of their geographic situation. And it is possible that the Commanders will eventually be forced out of the area by the Ravens. The Ravens are a far more successful franchise, obviously, since the Ravens have shown up here. In a lot of ways, Jack Kent Cook's worst fears have come true, much in the same way that the worst fears imaginable for the Orioles have come true. And it should have never allowed that in baseball. And I can understand Cook's fears about the Ravens coming here. I still hate his guts, but I still can understand it. in terms of that, if the Ravens are going to fight that and try and find ways to get new revenue, I want to see a complete new commitment to international marketing, or at least feasibility on the relative cost and how they can win from it. And I'm at a point now where I don't even mind if it meant one game a year in Germany or one game every 2 years in Germany, which would probably be the more likely thing, where the Ravens become Germany's team. Mm-hmm. Like, that would be a reasonable solution for the international marketing situation. It would be a big, you know, losing games in Baltimore sucks. As a season ticket holder, I don't want to have that happen. But on the other hand, I'd love to pick up another, I guess Germany's about 70 million. No, it's more than that. It's more than that now. 80 million people, let's call it, that are a lively fan base to add to what the Ravens currently now have in their metro area here. They've got to figure out a way to find an extremely large additional group of people to draw from as fans.
Yeah. Or South America potentially. I guess Germans have
not as much money there.
Right. Yeah. More money. Yeah. Did you have another one?
No, that's one. If I was looking at something else in the organization, okay, I'll give you another one. I think Harbaugh, as a direct report of Bisciotti, could take advice on communications from him. The first thing I would change, I don't want too much to meddle with my direct report, who I'm generally speaking happy with. If he stays, that's going to be generally the case. What it is, he's more happy than not. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't mind having a discussion with him about how you communicate about injuries, and just say our only comment is no comment. I would love to see that. I wouldn't reach down in the organization on any further than the very top spots. But in the DaCosta's case, you talked about positional valuation. I'd say it's fair for Bisciotti to make very clear to DaCosta and to the rest of the organization what his stance is on void years and leveraging future cap dollars into the current year. And I think that's they've got to be of one mind on that, or they've got to be of one set of actions on that relative to whoever makes that decision, which is probably Bisciotti.
Yeah. I mean, Bisciotti's sitting in the draft room. It's not like he's, out of, he sits, what was it? He's at right across from DaCosta.
He's in the wisecrack section, believe me.
Harbaugh sits to Bisciotti's left. Bisciotti sits between Ozzie and Harp, and Ozzie still sits at the head. I just watched the replay, the Wired of the draft this last year. And anyway, I guess I'll give one more to Chad Steele in that portion. I think they've turned off some of the fan base with being standoffish when asked tough questions, or saying, the fans want to know why Keaton Mitchell isn't playing, or that sort of thing. I think a softer tone would be appreciated. And I think Harbaugh has changed his communication style during this year. We've heard him take accountability directly and say, those turnovers were my fault. I went a long time without him saying something specifically was his fault. And now you have him fielding questions about his job security in a cordial way. And I think he has kind of, humbled. At least he comes off a little more humble than he used to me.
All right. Well, that's a perfectly reasonable thing. I think that's as much as we can do on this question for today. But that's a great topic. Really appreciate the question, Prof. Boggs, and I think that's a good way to put it. Other folks out there, please hit us up #FilmStudyMailbag Film Study Mailbag. Whatever show you want done, including those short 1 to 3 minute videos. So there'll be one of those, as I said, on the Lamar article that was written. Voss, always a pleasure doing the show with you. Can you tell folks where they can talk to you online or talk football with you if they want to?
Yeah. So I am on Twitter X at Vasilis Fiamata, VASILISFIAMATA. Always enjoy the show, Ken. Let's hope the Ravens keep it going, and happy new year, safe and prosperous for everyone.
Yeah. Especially that the safe part, I can't stress enough. You're going to be out and you're going to be drinking tonight. Consider Uber, consider how you're going to get home. Consider having a designated driver, and please stay safe on the roads in particular. You don't want to have the worst possible start to your new year. So for Voss Larikos, this is Ken McCusick saying goodbye. We'll talk to you next week on Friday Morning GM.